Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at Shopify.com/RedCircle, all lowercase. Go to Shopify.com/RedCircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/RedCircle.
Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to this episode of Food Psych, and please excuse my voice. I have a cold, hopefully the last one of this very long illness season, but we shall see. But I didn't have it when I did this interview, so most of the episode is much more easy listening. This is another fan favorite cross-posted from my other pod, Rethinking Wellness, that I think you'll really love as a listener of Food Psych. In it, I talk with parent coach Una Hansen about how going to a physical therapist for back pain led her down a wellness culture rabbit hole, why dietary restrictions to quote-unquote fight inflammation just ended up harming her relationship with food and her body, how she got the dubious diagnosis of adrenal fatigue, and more. Behind the paywall, we get into how she helped her child heal from an eating disorder and how that process changed the course of her career, how parents can help their kids navigate pressures from diet and wellness culture, why smart and science-minded people can still fall for wellness misinformation, her experience with perimenopause and wellness culture, and more. This was a great conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you. First, I want to let you know about a couple resources you might find helpful, one of which is my latest book, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which I co-authored last year with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care, who I'm honored to work with and who have been multiple-time guests on this very podcast, and their episodes were among the top fan favorites of all time. We joined forces to create a workbook for clinicians and general readers alike that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about when and what you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and fitness, and lots more. If any of that sounds helpful to you, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or click the link in the show notes. Also, if you're new here and you want a deeper understanding of many of the things we talk about on this podcast, like weight stigma, eating disorder recovery, intuitive eating, and why diet culture is so harmful, don't sleep on my first book, Anti-Diet. It was published way back in 2019, and of course there are some things I'd update about it, but it's still going strong, and I still hear from people all the time about how helpful it's been to them. If you want to get that, you can go to ChristyHarrison.com/antidiet or find it anywhere books are sold. Now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Una Hansen. I'm excited to talk with you about your experience with wellness culture and particularly being mislabeled with a dubious diagnosis of adrenal fatigue and what that did to your relationship with food and your body. But first, I'd love to hear a bit about your history with diet and wellness culture up to that point. How much did they influence you growing up in childhood or early adulthood?
You know, I was thinking about how in many ways I was protected from a lot of diet and wellness culture as a pretty young kid, you know, being in a smaller body. And there just wasn't a lot of diet talk in my home. But in the teen years, I definitely, like a lot of my peers, struggled with body image and disordered eating. And I really vowed when I became a parent, which is something I always wanted to do, that I was going to do things differently. And at the same time, I was really vulnerable to a lot of the wellness messages out there. So even thinking about, you know, becoming a parent for the first time, only a few years after the retracted Lancet article about vaccines, you know, I started to have these questions about what kind of parenting I would do in terms of, you know, even in terms of how I wanted to have childbirth, right? I had this vision that it was really important to me to have a natural childbirth. My husband and I went to, you know, weekly intensive classes, and it was just really, I held so tightly to this idea that if I did everything right, if I followed someone's rules about how to do things the right way, and especially the natural way, that I would be guaranteed a particular outcome. And when that didn't end up panning out, you know, my birth plan did not go as planned.
Same.
I feel like that should have been my wake-up call that, hey, maybe you can't control everything about, you know, your state of health or your medical outcomes, things like that. In some way that I almost kind of doubled down on myself, you know, I'm going to make my own baby food. You know, it all made sense to me. It felt right to me. And yet, again and again, the reality of life, the reality of parenting, you know, kept kind of like butting up against these like very, you know, idealized ideas of what kind of well-being or wellness for our family would look like.
Do you feel like that desire to parent, quote unquote, naturally and do things by the book that wellness culture dictates, like, do you think that's a product of your value system in some way, or was, you know, at the time, or like the cultural milieu that you were in? You know, for me, it was like part of this kind of ethos and value system that I was a part of, and this cultural milieu and group that I was, you know, around and in. So I'm curious if any of that was at play for you in your decision to like do natural childbirth and make your own baby food and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think there must have been people in my environment that reinforced some of these ideas. I definitely can think of one friend in particular who I probably looked up to. You know, she didn't just have natural childbirth. She had home birth. And I mean, you know, worked out great for her and her family. What's interesting is that I was pre-med in undergrad, and I have lots of friends who are doctors. I've never thought of myself as like anti-Western medicine or anything like that, but somehow I thought I was bringing in the best of both worlds, right? I didn't want to have a birth at home. I knew I was going to have a birth in a hospital, but I wanted to do it with this one specific way that I had in mind that would be like the best way or the better way. And looking back, I think a lot of it really comes back to kind of perfectionistic tendencies that, like, I don't do gymnastics, but if I did gymnastics, I would have gone for like the Simone Biles vault, right? Like, let me go for the highest level of difficulty and see if I can get there. And I think all of the sort of wellness culture messages really were appealing to that, right? Like, here's this, like, let's raise the bar on what a person, especially a woman, especially a mother, might have to do. You know, I don't know what gold stars I thought were coming at the end, but that's sort of like, when I think about it, it was more like it tapped into maybe my temperament more than my milieu. Although, of course, living in Los Angeles, it is always around me, even if I'm not picking it up directly.
I'm curious, you know, you wrote that you started really down this particular wellness culture rabbit hole of thinking you had adrenal fatigue and kind of going hard on wellness diets and stuff by going to a physical therapist for back pain. Can you talk about that experience a little bit?
I was having the thing where you're throwing out your back. I don't even know if that's a technical term, but I think anyone who's had the experience knows what I'm talking about. Well, I kept throwing out my back, you know, even doing things like brushing my teeth, or I wasn't doing anything super strenuous, and it would happen. And was very painful and very scary and made it hard to take care of my family and take care of myself. And I can't remember how I found this person, but someone I trusted recommended this particular physical therapist. And I actually found her really helpful. She gave me so many great exercises and stretches, even helped me realize things about my gait and posture that were sort of carryovers from pregnancy, where I hadn't kind of like gotten back into my normal rhythm of how I sat and walked and stood up. And those were really, really helpful. So I had developed this level of trust. And for anyone who's like had a physical therapist work on your like piriformis muscle, like you're pretty vulnerable. To keep doing that, you have to really trust this person. And I really valued her input. And she said, you know, I wonder if part of this is coming from inflammation. And I had never really even thought about that concept. I mean, I knew that certain medications were like anti-inflammatory, like Advil or things like that. I hadn't really heard the idea of like systemic inflammation before, but I trusted her. I was open to her suggestions. And she said, I know this woman, this is what she does. Like, she'd be great for you. And so like the good A student I've always been, I went and, you know, contacted her, booked the package of sessions. And I was really, really hopeful that this was going to be like a game changer for me.
Yeah, the PT recommended this health coach for inflammation. What did that coach tell you to do?
So the first step was submitting saliva samples to a lab. And then there was like this elaborate report that came back to her and to me. And it confirmed what she already said she thought she was thinking was going on with me. And she, quote unquote, diagnosed me with adrenal fatigue. And I understood like some of the science of how like our hormone system works, but you know, I didn't know enough to catch some red flags about how some of this didn't quite add up. So at the time I was buying it. It felt like it made sense. And so yeah, from that, she went right into recommending pretty extreme dietary restrictions. And you know, it didn't sound easy. It didn't sound fun, but I was like, okay, this is like that Simone Biles vault. Like I can do this high degree of difficulty. I'm very disciplined. I'm very organized. I can do this. And then when I couldn't, you know, it just was this letdown of, you know, that I was failing at this protocol that she was giving me. And week after week, I just started feeling worse and worse, not only physically, but just feeling worse about myself and my ability to take care of myself. And the irony that here I am paying so much money for this private personalized health coach, I was really going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that's so, so painful. And I think so many of us can relate. You know, it's like you have these symptoms and whatever is going on that's not really being addressed by other methods. And then someone comes along claiming to know what's up and having a scientific sounding explanation for it. And it is hard when you're not a specialist in something to pick up on those red flags of like, this person doesn't quite get it or have the whole story or whatever. And if they're using words that you are familiar with from like pre-med, for example, it's like, you know, you might be like, okay, this person seems to know what she's talking about. I'm curious how it made you feel to have that diagnosis of quote unquote adrenal fatigue. And also like, how do you know anything about the lab that she sent the samples to and sort of what it actually was?
You know, I probably still have it in a file somewhere. That would be an interesting thing to go dig up. You know, I think at first it felt really validating. It's like, yeah, I am really tired. Yeah, I have been under a lot of stress. Like having someone just acknowledge that, that's probably what I felt the best, right? Was hearing someone say to me, you have too much on your plate. Like you are overwhelmed. The idea of like burning out your adrenal glands, like, but the idea of burnout, like that resonated, right? It's like, okay, oh, but like there's a biological thing going on that I can fix rather than thinking about like, what are the stressors in my life? And could I find ways to address those instead going right to trying to solve this problem through food without ever realizing that this is going to add a lot more stress. It just like looking back, I'm like, how did I get so bamboozled by this? But at the time it made sense.
I mean, food seems so benign, right? At first, when you think about it and you're not thinking about the side effects or the possibilities, it's like, okay, well, I don't have to do any sort of medication or expensive scans or whatever. It's just like what I buy at the grocery store and I can change it. And I have this power to like fix things through food. It feels empowering. I don't know. It definitely felt empowering to me to think I have the tools at my disposal to make these changes. And I don't need anyone else, you know, other than like the people to tell me what the diet is. But like, I can actually carry this out myself.
Yeah. And living in Los Angeles, the upside is I could walk to a Trader Joe's and I had a Whole Foods and I could access these foods that were being sort of so-called prescribed to me. So yeah, it felt like it should have been really doable.
And what was the reality of that? Like, what was she actually having you eat? Because some of the stuff you wrote about, I was just like, oh my God, I cannot imagine.
Well, gluten-free was the first thing. And that was like the peak of gluten-free mania, right? Where restaurants, everyone was convinced that they had this gluten sensitivity. So that was the first thing to cut out. And then, you know, things like added sugars, caffeine. Oh, that was a really brutal one for me. So the caffeine, alcohol, it kind of made sense. But yeah, gluten-free. I can't remember if dairy-free also came on the scene. But then, you know, some of the recipes. So she, you know, was like, oh, I'll send you recipes to make it easier. And there was like this bean and cabbage stew. She was like, you make a big batch and like have it for breakfast. And that was sort of like the beginning of like, this seems a little weird. Yeah. I mean, some of these recipes, I still have a few of them that I hold on to just to like remind myself of those days, but it was not easy. But I still wanted to follow the rules, like making these elaborate, you know, I had two little kids working part-time from home, husband working a lot outside the home. And to follow the rules, I just did the easiest things that I could do. Like what was accessible? Oh, Trader Joe's sells gluten-free JoJo's, right? Like the knockoff Oreos, or, you know, there are a lot of prepackaged items at Trader Joe's that fit the criteria technically, but probably weren't as nourishing as I really needed to like take care of my family and myself. So it really sent me down a rabbit hole of kind of binging on some of these snack foods or things, which, you know, I'm all for snacks. I'm not anti-processed foods or anything, but at the time, it just really felt like that was all I could do to follow the rules. And it wasn't really helping me feel nourished. I mean, I was grumpy all the time. I was feeling like there were things I couldn't eat that I wanted to eat. Meanwhile, I'm making food for my two kids. And yeah, it was just a recipe for stress and undereating, followed by probably some overeating or binge eating that just made me feel like I was like, wow, I really am a mess around food, right? But it was like it had created this problem. At least that's the way I started to see it by the end.
Yeah. I mean, it's good that you were able to see that. I feel like for so many of us, I know for myself, when I was in it, I didn't see the iatrogenic effects of, you know, restrictive eating until very late in the game, until really I was like mostly recovered. And at the time, it was just like, well, I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to be doing. Why am I so out of control with food? Sort of forgetting about the 20 years or whatever I had spent up until that point, feeling totally fine with food, you know, thankfully, because no one interfered in my relationship with food and I was able to be intuitive about it and, you know, never had an issue with it. And that is sheer luck, really, that happened. But I sort of forgot all of that great history that I had and was just like, oh, I'm destined to be a mess around food. I can't get it together. Like, what is wrong with me? And, you know, not seeing the role that the restriction was playing at all.
You know, and for me, the fact that my answer to feeling so chaotic around food was going on Weight Watchers. I have so much empathy for my past self because at the time that somehow made sense, partly because what was happening in my, I was gaining weight by trying to follow this restrictive diet. So you know, at the time, I thought that was a real problem to be solved. I think differently about those things now. But at the time, I was like, oh, I've got to get a handle on this. I better have like someone else tell me how to eat. It's like this lady didn't give me the tools that worked for me, but maybe this very well-established, trusted brand. And that was right when Oprah, you know, became a shareholder and a spokesperson. And, you know, it was like, oh, this is going to be great. I thought this was going to solve all my problems.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like such a trusted brand. And I remember people talking, even when I was in school to become a dietitian, people talking about Weight Watchers in sort of glowing terms, like, oh, it's a really like solid diet and it's been around for a long time and it's got science behind it, you know, and it's sort of like framed as this thing that was unassailable. And the reality is so different. All I'm curious to dig into one other aspect of the work with this health coach, which was that she had you track your blood sugar. I think that is so problematic. And of course, we're seeing that so much more now in people without diabetes, that they're being encouraged to like track their blood sugar, wear continuous glucose monitors. And I just think it's so harmful to people's relationships with food because, you know, it can, well, first of all, there's no actual evidence-based guidelines for what blood sugars should be, like random glucose tests should be for people without diabetes. And, you know, diagnosing diabetes is not even done with random glucose tests. It's not postprandial glucose. It's, you know, fasting glucose. And it's also A1C, which is like a measure of glucose control over several months. You know, these random readings of like glucose after a meal or just a random time of day don't really tell you anything when you don't have diabetes, you know? And so like, I'm just curious what that information kind of did to your relationship with food and your sense of, you know, your body's functioning, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I probably skipped over that because it was such a nightmarish part of the experience. Yeah. And this was before the like fancy continuous glucose monitors that people can buy now. This, you know, I was going to, you know, I was using the little lancet, like pricking my finger and using the test strips that way, which, you know, again, like this is where it all started. It's so scientific, right? Like sending in your saliva sample. Now I'm testing my blood. You know, it's almost a little bit like biohacking or something, right? It's like, let me really understand, you know, what's going on in my body. But it only made eating more stressful. And it was very confusing. And I wasn't given a lot of guidance. I was just supposed to keep a journal. But I knew that like the impression was higher numbers were bad. And that lower numbers were better.
So it was all just relative. It was like, if this one meal seems to raise your glucose more than this other meal, then that first meal is bad because it's raising it more, not having any sort of benchmark or whatever of like, this is all within the normal range.
Right. I don't think I was given a range. This was sort of the next level since, you know, the following the diet so you know, that I was being prescribed wasn't so-called working, right? Now we're going to drill down and see like where in what's currently allowed, are there some foods that are a little bit more problematic for me, right? That was the message I got was like, okay, now we're really going to fine tune. We're going to figure out what else we need to cut out or what else we need to change. And I was like, okay, I'm going for it. I really have a vivid memory, and I wrote about this in the piece, of going to one of our favorite restaurants as a family and really enjoying this meal. And I was sort of like, it almost had like a cheat day mentality because I was like, I just want to eat, enjoy this. This is not following all the rules, but I'm going to enjoy this meal. But I was still in the back of my mind worried, maybe this is going to show that I shouldn't have this anymore. Like I was having that almost that Last Supper kind of thinking around that meal. And sure enough, when I did the finger prick, it was like the highest reading I had had. So it really made me afraid. Like, am I never going to be able to eat at this restaurant that's like at the time was the one place that everyone enjoyed, right? Which if you try to, it's so hard with young kids. It was like, oh my gosh, the perfect place. And everyone has things they like, and there's things we share, and it's always this fun outing. And now it was like, it felt ruined. And it was really heartbreaking and also kind of scary. Like, oh my gosh, have I been hurting myself with this food all this time? Yeah.
Which again, there's like, I can totally empathize with feeling that way. And it's just, it feels outrageous to me that there was no sense from the health coach of like, this is still within the normal range and like, you don't need to worry. And, you know, maybe we should test your A1C if anything, right? If she was really concerned about anything with blood sugar rather than just this random reading after a meal.
Right. If only I knew then what I know now.
Yeah. And if only she knew then, like what she ought to have known too. Yeah. And so, and then you wrote about like this sort of interesting fallout from that, right? That you like checked again after going to that restaurant again and having a really restrictive meal. And then like just sort of the ways that your blood sugar seemed to fluctuate in response to different things was not what you would have expected.
Yeah, it was really all over the place because, again, at the time I was being told it was all about food, right? That was like the number one thing that was, or how you're combining foods. I think the real eye-opener for me was New Year's Eve when we had our traditional hors d'oeuvre dinner as a family. We had such a good time. We were wearing our silly hats. We had, you know, Ina Garten's onion dip. We had all our favorite things. And, you know, I even had a couple of cocktails. You know, we were celebrating New Year's Eve. And I was like, oh, it'd be kind of funny to test my blood sugar now. And I was almost kind of laughing, like, what is it going to be? And it was lower than all these other meals that were really restrictive. You know, my next session with the health coach, I said, what's up with this? Like, let me tell you what I ate and then what my blood sugar reading was. She's like, oh, well, you were relaxed and having a good time. And I mean, I can laugh now, but at the time it was like that was the beginning of thinking, maybe there's something about this attempt to over control or restrict food or be afraid of food that is actually doing way more harm than good. So, you know, I try to hold on to that feeling of like enjoying food in the company of people you love. Like, it's so nourishing. And the idea that, you know, unless you have diabetes and you have to check your blood sugar, that your body can handle it. And it actually could be really good for your body.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, so important to know. And I'm glad that you were able to kind of glean that from that experience. How did you finally stop working with that health coach?
So, you know, I had prepaid for a package of sessions. And, you know, after that New Year's Eve kind of light bulb moment, and I was, you know, asking a lot of questions, her whole vibe kind of shifted, right? And she was like, well, you know, you're really having a hard time, you know, following these rules. And because you're having such a hard time, you know, I almost wonder if you have disordered eating or an eating disorder. And I remember thinking, if you were worried about clients having disordered eating or eating disorders, you should have evaluated, like, that's something it seems like you should evaluate someone for before you prescribe restrictive diets. And I was like, I don't think I do. If anything, it's this that we're doing that's creating this disordered relationship with food and how I feel so chaotic and I feel worried about eating. Like, these are the things you taught me to do. And so that was like, okay, I'm not renewing. I'm not going to go to package number two and upgrade or whatever it was called. That was really like, I knew I was doing the right thing by stopping this program, but it wasn't easy to then to just go right back to sort of like my normal way of eating. Like, this disruption had, like, I couldn't unlearn some of the things. I still had some of that nagging suspicion that certain things maybe were problematic. So that was the tough piece, that it wasn't like I could be like, okay, I'm done with you and wash my hands of it. It's like some of that really stuck with me.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's my experience and the experience of so many clients and people I've spoken to as well, is like, there's just this residue of each diet or each orthorexic sort of protocol or whatever that sticks around in your mind. And those rules and those voices judging you for eating particular things are still there. And then even if you go on to a new diet, there's still that residue still sticks around. And so maybe you're restricting certain things within the new diet, even if it doesn't have the same sort of protocol or restrictions or whatever. And so it's like you're kind of piling on the restrictions. I'm curious if that was your experience when you went to Weight Watchers and how that all played out.
Yeah, those layers of like sediment, right, of these different diets. Yeah, some of it did kind of overlap, right? Because some of her messages about carbohydrates kind of matched some of the Weight Watchers, the way they valued, like the way the point system worked. There was some overlap. So even though I thought I was kind of getting this refresh to kind of like retrain myself to get into like a healthier pattern, in many ways, it really just doubled down on a lot of the same fears or rules, and obviously reinforcing a lot of fear of weight gain. And, you know, the fact that it wasn't just about, you know, this is pre-Noom, right? This was really, you know, this was not like OG Weight Watchers. This was like the app, you know, Oprah. You know, again, it felt very scientific in terms of like how you were putting things in your app. And yeah, I thought it was going to be like my little buddy to get back kind of back on track to my normal. And of course, in the back of my mind, I'm also thinking, I want to lose the weight that I gained on this health coaching protocol. So it was a really unpleasant time.
What did that do to your relationship with food and your body to be on Weight Watchers? Do you feel like it compounded things or took them in a new direction?
how could it not, right? I mean, the fact that you're seeing a little graph of your weight. I think we even bought the Weight Watchers branded scale. My husband also did it for a little bit with me, like I think to be supportive, you know? And yeah, that graph of your weight and the way that you would sort of feel like the graph was going in the wrong direction. And again, the amount of food it was saying that I should eat to reach my supposed goal, like looking back, knowing what I know now, it was so low. I mean, it's like toddler level nutrition for, you know, a grown woman with two kids. And so it really was just reinforcing restriction, reinforcing my own internalized weight stigma. And it also, I think, really encouraged some of that kind of like cheat day or binge mentality, because the idea of like saving up your points, right? I mean, it was just like, you know, people restricting all day before going to a party or something. Like it was that same kind of restrict binge cycle that I had experienced a little bit on this health protocol as well, or even in sort of disordered eating, like before prom type stuff that I might've experienced like as an adolescent. Yeah, it just sort of reinforced all those things.
And did you notice that at the time and think like, this is not actually taking me to the peaceful relationship with food that I want, or did it take a while to break out of that?
It took a while. Again, I used to feel a lot of shame about having succumbed to all these things, but I mean, I have compassion for other people so easily, but for myself, you know, it's like, how could I have fallen for this? It took me a while. I also, you know, as a mom trying to have a healthy food culture for my kids, I remember cutting the labels off of the recipes I had printed out. I didn't want the kids to see the words Weight Watchers on these recipes. So like, I knew that I was kind of straddling the fence of like, I want my kids to feel relaxed around food and feel good about their bodies, but I'm over here doing this other thing, but I'm going to try to keep it a secret. So that was that, I know, that cognitive dissonance or that internal tension where like, this isn't feeling right to me. And, you know, it ultimately came to a head when one of my kids developed an eating disorder. And so, you know, all my best laid plans of making this healthy food culture in my home, because I had a very simplistic idea of what that would involve, but I thought I had it all figured out. You know, that was really my harsh wake-up call that there cannot be any food restriction happening in a home where food restriction is threatening my kid's life. It was a no-brainer, right, that something big had to change.
Yeah, I'm sad for you that and your family that it had to come to that. But also, you know, sometimes I feel like that happens for people. It takes something major like that to kind of shake them out of their, the sort of just the way that diet culture and wellness culture kind of condition us to relate to food and our bodies, that it's just so easy to get sucked into that and to feel like you have to keep restricting in some way and that there's good and bad foods and that you need to always be trying to lose weight. And it's hard to see the flaws in that until you are confronted sometimes with, you know, an eating disorder or something where it's like, it's very clear the negative impacts of that kind of thinking.
Yeah. And I want to be really honest and share that it wasn't as if I had this lightning bolt moment where, okay, I'm done with all restrictive thoughts about food or negative thoughts about my body. It was still hard. Like the unlearning, even though this was literally life and death, it was still hard. And I think that's what helps me have empathy for people who are having a hard time breaking out of diet culture or wellness culture, because even in an extreme situation like we were in, it was still hard. And, you know, as I shared with you before, it was like things like your Food Psych podcast that really were helping me like retrain my thinking and relearn and unlearn some of the things from diet culture. Because I needed support, right? This is really hard to do on your own. And you're also caring for a kid who needs a lot of, you know, support. So for anyone listening who's, you know, going through something like that, I just send so much compassion and empathy because it is really, really hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just curious what you did to help your kid heal that worked for you. I know it's different probably for different families, but I'm curious what approach maybe was the most helpful for you.
Yeah, I mean, we tried everything. We followed you know, doctor's orders. We, you know, went up the all the levels of care, really did sort of the traditional or conventional approaches to treatment, and it wasn't working. So someone had said, you know, maybe it's time to try family-based treatment, FBT, or some folks in the UK might know it as the Maudsley method. And we had been discouraged from doing this early on. We had heard people with a lot of letters after their name telling us, you know, that FBT was sort of fringe, that there are horror stories that people shared, and, you know, not to go that route, you know, but we had tried everything else. So we're like, well, we might as well give this a try. And we took the whole family to San Diego for their 1 week intensive, almost like a boot camp for learning about FBT. And that was a game changer. And that saved my kid's life. And I think it saved our family, because it's what actually got my kid well. It helped us learn how we could be supportive, rather than it's, you know, that I think a lot of parents get the message of like, okay, back off. Don't be the food police. Let the professionals handle this. And maybe parents are part of the problem. So, you know, like there's this sort of like suspicion around parents when it comes to eating disorders. And you feel that as a parent, especially as a mom. You know, we never look back, you know, really laid the groundwork for a really robust recovery. So I'm so grateful for that. And that's what really quickly led me to shift my parent education work to body image and eating disorders, because, you know, I had a little bit of like the zealotry of the newly converted. I'm like, you know, but I will say someone very early on had told me, oh, go to San Diego, do FBT, drop everything, fire everybody. And that was actually a big turnoff. Like they came on so strong and it made me feel like I was doing everything wrong. It was almost like some of the stuff I'd been through before, where I was just feeling like I had, you know, I wasn't doing things so-called the right way. I did learn not to come on too strong. If people were asking me for help with their kid, you know, I would try to understand their concerns about FBT or their questions about FBT. I would never say that one size fits all, that FBT is right for every family. I don't think there is one size fits all when it comes to recovery. But I think a lot more parents and families could get help if they really understood what FBT is or can be in the hands of a really thoughtful provider or at a treatment center that focuses on that approach and gives a more personalized approach, not just maybe a by-the-book, manualized delivery of the treatment.
What were some of the key differences that you found in the version of FBT that you practiced versus what you had sort of imagined or thought that it would be?
Boy, that's a really good question. The message we got was that if parents are the so-called food police, right, that if parents are paying attention to what the child is eating, that you're going to make the eating disorder worse. I think, you know, that sort of feels right, right? The messages you hear about, you know, like what I would tell a parent who wants to try to lower the risk for an eating disorder would be not to comment on what your kid is eating. But when there's actually an eating disorder already happening, to ignore, you know, what the child is eating, it's probably not going to end well. So there's sort of some counterintuitive things about FBT. Also, the idea, you know, I was told FBT, you know, you're taking away your teenager's autonomy, and that is going to be just horrible for their mental health. But not realizing that when someone is in the throes of an eating disorder, they don't have autonomy. You know, they're being controlled by the eating disorder and they really need your help. The other piece was being told that it would ruin my relationship with my kid forever, right? That some kids never speak to their parents again after doing FBT. So, I mean, there's a lot of scary messages you're getting about, rather than helping, that this could actually like break your family apart. You know, that's horrifying. And I don't doubt people who've had those experiences. I think, you know, I trust people's lived experience, you know, in their assessment of what happened. But we were lucky enough to get really good support and training and work with a really wonderful provider. I used to work at an eating disorder treatment program that focused on FBT for adolescents, and just seeing how many incredible therapists and dietitians and medical providers who really gave this kind of supportive approach to FBT that helped everyone feel, you know, it's not going to feel good, but feel really confident in the process and getting support during those kind of like bumps in the road.
Yeah, that's great. It's really helpful to hear. I'm thinking about like the people that I've known who, because I've known clients and people I've worked with who've had success with FBT and others who've found it really hard and not helpful. And the ones that have not had a good experience with it, I feel like it's often from the client's perspective, who knows what, you know, from the parent's perspective, but this was like when I was working with clients who were then adults and reflecting back on their own FBT experiences, saying that they felt like they experienced some like hypocrisy from their parents, sort of like double standard, right? That was like the client, the kid's meal was being policed, but the parent was sort of able to do like disordered things that weren't being called out or like that wasn't being acknowledged. I think that's the theme in like the few people that I'm thinking of who had that experience. And so I wonder if part of what made FBT helpful and effective for your family was that you were starting to reflect on those things for yourself and like, you know, make peace with food for yourself and ready to give up the dieting and the disordered eating as opposed to kind of staying locked into that. And that's not to blame any parent who does that and has FBT not work, because everybody has their own journey and parents struggle with eating disorders and disordered eating as well. And it's not like an easy fix. So I'm sure, like you said, you don't just flip a switch and it's all fine. But I wonder if there's a certain like level of readiness that may have helped for you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, learning about things like health at every size and the concept of all foods fit and just getting support to realize that if we're afraid of what the eating disorder is afraid of, that's cruel, right? If you're trying to help someone recover from, you know, in this case, it was anorexia, you know, that like we need to be on the same team here, right? It's not parent versus kid. It's kid and parent versus this eating disorder and diet culture, because obviously that does complicate recovery. Yeah, so it did mean bringing back foods into our home that we hadn't had in a while, you know, for a long time, you know, no diet sodas, you know, anything. I've kind of reclaimed Diet Coke as a once in a while thing, you know, at the time, like anything that even had a whiff of sort of diet food or diet, you know, anything, we no longer had that. And we really tried to focus on making food delicious and abundant, and the fact that we weren't afraid of the necessary weight gain for recovery. I think that can really hold families back, because we live in such an anti-fat society. It makes sense that people are afraid of letting their kids' body recover in the way it needs to. So we were really lucky that we had, you know, the therapist that was supporting us, you know, was very well versed in all of this and was very supportive and helped us navigate moments where we had questions. You know, even the pediatrician, you know, was like, I don't know about this weight range. You know, we had to come up against some weight stigma in the process, which I think a lot of families do. So yeah, I do feel like the treatment with the team we had and having a part, you know, having my husband and I on the same, you know, we were just so supportive of each other. We were all on the same page. You know, it really made a difference.
Yeah, that's huge. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, one question I have for you now that you are a parent educator on eating disorders and body image is I would love to hear some of your advice to other parents for navigating this world that we live in, this diet culture, right? Because I think, you know, as much as parents might try to create an environment of food and body acceptance at home, kids are going to go out in the world and they're going to encounter weight stigma and they're going to encounter diety messages and wellness culture messages from, you know, their doctors, their schools, which teach nutrition lessons, wellness TikTok, and all these different places, right? As a parent, how can you prevent eating disorders or disordered eating from taking root when kids are exposed to all these things?
It's really hard. So I send so much compassion to families. At the same time, I do feel really strongly that having a safe haven at home is a powerful thing.
That was the first half of my interview with Una Hansen, and there's so much more to come. To hear it, become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com or click the link in the show notes. And if you're already a paid subscriber and you happen to be hearing this, look at your welcome email for instructions on how to set up your special podcast feed so that you don't have to hear these preview outros. You can just listen to the whole thing seamlessly. In the meantime, you can find Una and learn more about her work at unahansen.com and read her newsletter, Parenting Without Diet Culture, at unahansen.substack.com. Thanks so much to her for coming on the show. If you like this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe or follow Rethinking Wellness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and take a moment to rate and review if you liked it too. Thanks for being here, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.